Welcome to The Pen and the Yad. Join Rabbi Michael Siegel from Anshe Emet Synagogue in Chicago and author Jonathan Eig as they talk about this week's Torah portion, Chaye Sarah, Abraham and his descendants and the ownership of land.
Well, this portion of Chaye Sarah has a whole variety of firsts. Sarah is the first Jew to die. She dies very suddenly. And Abraham is the first person in the Torah to cry. He mourns over Sarah's death. And later on in the portion, you have the first person who loves his spouse, at least it's the, where the Torah describes it as love. People knowing their spouse, but loving their spouse, well, that's reserved for Isaac and Rebekah, which is a very, very powerful issue. But there is another first that almost cries out to us to interpret today, and that is that Abraham has left everything that he knows for a promise. His descendants will become a great nation, numerous, but that they'll also be given the land. But all he has is a promise, and now Sarah has died. They are in that land, but he is landless, and he is completely at the mercy of the residents of the land to bury his wife. So I'm going to pause for a minute and just sort of have you as an author try to help us understand Abraham's feelings in that moment.
Wow. You know, we obviously this cries out to us, as you said, this Torah portion cries out to us because there's so much that we can reflect on right now about land and about having a home. And it seems like when Abraham loses Sarah, that he wants a place to bury her that suggests that this is his home, that this is, you know, his land, that he's entitled to bury her there. And so much of who we are is tied up in our homes and feeling like there's a place for us. And I guess when we lose somebody, we want to bury them someplace that feels like it belongs to us, that we can connect to it. And it seems like that's what Abraham is struggling with right now.
I'm going to build on that and say that I think he also wants to have a sense that this promise has some sort of reality to it. It's not just a promise that I carry with me. It's my private conversation with God. Now, Abraham does this whole sale publicly, right? He does it in front of the town. It's a legal document. And if you look at the Torah, it actually gives the borders. So what you're looking at isn't just a story, but it's a land deed that Abraham has effected. And as he lays his wife to rest, or has the desire to lay his wife to rest, the people are saying, "Oh, Abraham, we understand your pain and we see your need. We'll give you land. Don't worry, you don't have to pay us." Because they don't want to give up the land. This is the whole issue. They don't want to give up the land, but Abraham is a man of means, and he's also a man of power. And so he makes them basically an offer they can't refuse. He says, "Give me a number." And he gives them some ridiculously large number, and he takes it. And there's nothing they can do about it. And so here you have, I think, encapsulated the history of Abraham's descendants on that land. It is always going to be a struggle to not only possess the land, but to own it. And that ownership comes under criticism. And you can feel the tension there, and you can feel the tension now. And I guess it cries out to us, what do we do with this text?
So they wanted to give him the land, but they weren't going to give him ownership of it, is what you're saying.
No, exactly.
Own it. And so much of our world's struggles are tied up into who owns land, right? And who created this concept? I'm not qualified here, but to discuss the roots of this, but who created this concept that you can own land and that one person can say, "I own it and you can't have it." And we obviously fight, we go to war over who owns land. And it's just such complicated and conflict-ridden concept throughout all of human history that we feel this desire to own the place we live. And that creates literal wars.
Are you talking about this as individuals? Are you talking about the whole idea of nationalism?
Oh, I think they're connected. I think the sense that you can own a piece of land and that other people can't use it seems to me that it's philosophically tied to the idea that this is our land and not yours, and that your people can't come on it. And that's, you know, true in nationalism as well.
Well, it's a much larger concept than I was thinking in terms of. I think that the whole issue of ownership of land, of nation states, is a topic of concern in our own day. The European Union, for instance, is a statement that Europe, it may be made up of different nations, but they're all kind of joined together in this corporation called the European Union. So that in many ways, nation states, you know, boundaries and armies and this and that, that has fallen out of favor with many. The United States and Israel are amongst those that believe very strongly in this idea of borders and boundaries and creating their own state. And the reality is, for Jews, I don't know how we could even conceive of Israel as anything but, you know, a bounded land. This idea that there's a one-state solution out there means pretty much that there's just no Israel at the end of the day. Now, maybe the world would be happier that way, but I don't think the Jewish people in our history could allow or countenance the idea that we could be with a place without a homeland or an army to protect us. So your idea of ownership is also tied up with security. And I'm not sure what you do with that.
Well, we're really going off the
interesting grid here.
It's the same thing with, you know, with putting a fence around your property and saying you can't come on it. I just see the parallels here between individual ownership of land and national ownership of land. And it's absolutely a human instinct to want to feel safe, to preserve your space, to want to know that when you bury your wife, you're doing it on your own land and that not someone else's. All of that is absolutely human nature. And the same way that you feel like you want to protect your nation if you're for any nation.
Okay. So then you're making the argument for ownership.
Yeah. But I'm also saying that it's fraught, that philosophically, I just wonder, you know, how anyone can claim ownership of land. That's something God created, right?
Right. But later on in the Torah, God is going to say, this is the land for this tribe. This is the land for this tribe. God's saying, I'm giving you this land. So God says, I'm the owner, I created the world, I'm giving you this land. The idea behind it is that ownership is really the most basic idea of the Torah, that ultimately the Jewish people are going to have, the descendants of Abraham are going to have a land of their own, and they're going to be able to live on it. And Abraham acts on that promise. Albert Einstein was a person who, after the Second World War, had all kinds of feelings, none of them positive, about the use of the bomb that part of his physics ideas helped to create. And he was very much against nationalism. But the exception that he made to the rule was Israel. He said the Jewish people need to have a state of its own. Without it, we are subject to the whims of the world. And so in a way, I think the story of the Jewish people is the greatest proof that one cannot depend on the goodwill of the nations or of human beings. We have to be able to, you know, have a boundary and have an army. And sometimes that's unpopular. This is one of those times. But there's no other way. And for Abraham, there was no other way. And by the way, when Jews decided to come back or said that the environment was right to come back to the land of Israel, they bought land. They bought swamp land. They bought land in the desert. But they bought the land. They purchased the land so that they could live there, so that we could have our own place in the world. I don't know that it's realistic for Jews to speak after the 20th century in terms of an idea that being without borders, to kind of give ourselves over to the whims of the world.
Well, there's no question about that. We'd be returning to the days of permanent exile, and that's unthinkable and untenable. And I don't know where I'm going with this. I just feel like it is inevitable that there will be conflict, as we're seeing now again, as we see with, you know, Native Americans in on this land. When you don't have a land of your own, you are helpless in many ways to control your own destiny.
It can be that way. I'm not sure that I would agree with you in terms of the Palestinians, that they haven't been able to control their own destiny. I think they've made choices along the mm-hmm. way. And that doesn't excuse the lost opportunities to further that effort. There's also evidence that the Israeli government was complicit at times in not helping the Palestinians create an entity. Certainly, that's the news coming out of Israel in terms of Netanyahu's relationship with Hamas. But regardless of that, let's just put that aside for a minute. Should the Jewish people have a land? That was the question in Abraham's time. That's the question in our time. And if we're going to have a land, we can't just be dependent upon a promise. We also have to have legal documents. The world voted to have to create a state. There's documentation for that. And while there were people that were unhappy, just like there were people unhappy in the time of Abraham, it was legally binding. We had a foothold in the land in the time of Abraham. We have that land now. How we manage it, how we protect it, what we do with it, that's the legacy Abraham leaves us. And unfortunately, in this particular moment in time, it is excruciating to see just how many people do not accept our place on that land.
No, I agree with you. It is excruciating, and it's the reason that we have wars, not just here today in Israel, but all over the world, that people fight over land, and who controls them and who has the army to control them. And it's the reality that grows from that determination that we should own our own land and that we must protect ourselves.
I guess the one thing that I want to say here is that Abraham also sets other examples. He's not just a nomadic tribal chieftain, kind of the swashbuckling, Indiana Jones type, but rather I also see Abraham as being a moral paragon. He and Sarah are the people who are the paradigms of Hachnasal Rahim, of how do you welcome people and how do you treat them? And we have to find a better balance here, too, because if you want to own land, then you also have to accept a morality that's going to treat people who are living on that land with equity. And that's a challenge. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But I also think that's part of the story. It's not one way or another, but it's both. And I'm hoping that we are going to live to see that day sooner rather than later, when we find a greater balance in that part of the world.
You know, we need that moral leadership so that we can maintain relationships, not only with people who are living on our land, but the people living around our land, our neighbors. It would be nice if we didn't see them all as enemies or rivals or threats.
But at the end of the day, Abraham wouldn't have received that land if he didn't have the ability to defend himself. The B'nai Chet, the people who sold him the land, didn't do it out of the goodness of their hearts. And so this is also the struggle for Israel, that it has to be able to show those living in that land that it can protect itself. It has to win respect on multiple levels. And that's the challenge of the moment. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you, Rabbi.